welcome to a special edition of the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. On August 2nd, 1990, Iraqi forces invaded Kuwait. The response from leaders around the world was swift, and then President H.W. Bush declared, "This will not stand." With this single move, Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein gained control of one-fifth of the world's oil supply. No one knew where he would stop, and the world held its breath wondering whether his forces would extend their offensive into neighboring Saudi Arabia. If he did, nearly 40% of the world's oil supply would have been under Saddam's control. What unfolded over the ensuing months was an incredible effort on political, diplomatic, and military levels. These events, each one a miracle of its own, set the stage for 43 days of intensive combat operations that would ultimately yield one of the most successful combat operations in history. From an aerospace power perspective, the campaign was revolutionary, seeing a wide range of highly advanced technologies, especially stealth and precision strike, and a new approach to strategy, an effects-based approach that would forever change how we fight. This was truly an aerospace power war, and the results were simply incredible. So given that context, we are here to dig into what made Operation Desert Storm such a success, the air campaign. We've dedicated three podcast episodes to dig into the air and space operations that made Desert Storm possible. Joining me today as co-host for these three special episodes is retired Colonel Rich Reynolds. He is an Air Force veteran and a distinguished expert when it comes to Desert Storm history. His book, Heart of the Storm, is an absolute must-read when it comes to understanding how the air campaign was built and the personalities that made it possible. Rich, thanks so much for being here.
Slick, you bet, and thanks for all that you've done getting the Aerospace Advantage podcast series flying. I'm going to be blunt. The simple truth is that in a matter of days after Saddam Hussein's forces invaded Kuwait, an informal cadre of mostly company and field grade officers in the basement of the Pentagon, led by an unconventional but unquestionably brilliant colonel who had recently arrived from his assignment as commander of the 36th TAC fighter wing, the premier fighter wing in Europe, and who with no authority nor any mandate to do so, put together the makings of a war plan that defeated Iraq with minimal casualties and combat losses in 43 days of fighting. The fact that this ad hoc group of planners was able to quickly gain the support of some in the Air Force leadership, including our guest today, the Vice Chief of Staff, General Mike Lowe, despite considerable pushback from others in the Pentagon and elsewhere, including the Air Force J3, Lieutenant General Jimmy Adams, and General Bob Rust, the commander of Tactical Air Command, is what allowed this plan to live and flourish. It was General Lowe's sponsorship that allowed several of these planners, including Colonel John Warden and Lieutenant Colonel Dave Deptula, to fly to MacDill and brief a very nervous and distraught General Schwarzkopf, the CENTCOM commander, about their newly developed plan that focused on air power and the defeat of Iraq's forces. Schwarzkopf welcomed that plan and directed Colonel Warden and his ad hoc team to go to the desert and brief the plan to Lieutenant General Horner. The rest is history. I'm here to tell you the campaign that the world saw unfold 30 years ago almost didn't happen. The institutional military was pitching a far different strategy, one that would have ignored key advantages of air power. It took a tremendous amount of courage and conviction on the part of some key players, including those that are here today, and put their careers on the line to make it happen. So, Slick, who do we have up first?
Well, Rich, today we'll hear from General Lowe, Lieutenant General Deptula, and Colonel John Warden, three of the critical players in the design and execution of the Desert Storm air campaign. General Mike Lowe, who was the Air Force Vice Chief of Staff when the war occurred, the number two uniform leader at Headquarters Air Force, was an absolute key actor in helping steer things in Washington, D.C. We've also got Colonel John Warden, who developed the initial strategy that set everything in motion and fundamentally shaped the vector of the war. And we've got our very own Mitchell Dean, retired Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, who was a Lieutenant Colonel at the time, working for the Secretary of the Air Force, and took an unexpected detour to Saudi Arabia to work with the Central Command Team as the lead air campaign planner. So, we're going to hear from the key guys who set the stage for the air war. Gentlemen, it's an honor to have you on today's show. I'd like to start off with you, General Lowe. Can you really give us a sense of what you are engaged in at the start of building the plan for Desert Storm?
Well, sure, Slick. Within a week, Less than a week after the beginning of the war, I was in the Pentagon as the vice chief. The chief of staff was away on a trip to Massachusetts, I believe. I get a call from General Schwarzkopf, the CENTCOM commander, and he wanted to talk to me about expanding the air contribution in the plans he already had. He already had an airland battle plan, which was pretty much isolated toward battlefield interdiction and close air support. Saddam Hussein was talking about deploying weapons of mass destruction from Baghdad. There were Scud missiles that were being fired toward Israel and could have been fired into Saudi Arabia that were coming out of the Baghdad area. So Schwarzkopf, smartly enough, said, hey, you know, I need more than just the airland battle campaign. I need a more strategic level campaign. And so he was thinking like an airman, and I give him great credit for that. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened that way. He wanted to expand it to include a strategic size air campaign, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. But he was an Army guy talking air power, and it was music to my ears. So I said, General Schwarzkopf, we've got the essence of that already started down in our checkmate section under a colonel named John Warden. He said, can you get back to me within a week? I said, we can get back to you in a heartbeat. So let me get Warden together. I'm going to have to take this through the staff and through the Joint Chiefs up here. And he said, don't worry about that. I'm going to call General Colin Powell and let him know you're on the way. And I said, well, trust me, we've got the essence of what you're looking for. I called down to the checkmate section. Within about 5 minutes, John Warden was up in my office briefing me on the work that he had already done.
General Lowe, what were your next steps?
Well, okay, so what I did when I hung up the phone from General Schwarzkopf, I immediately called General Bob Rust, the commander of TAC, who is the force provider for CENTCOM for fighters, and told him about this call and that I needed somebody to come up to the Pentagon because we were going to flesh out an air campaign right here. He complained a lot about it, but he sent General Tom Griffith up to the Pentagon to be part of that. My next call was out to Strategic Air Command. I talked to General Jack Chain, the SAC, commander-in-chief of SAC, told him the same thing, that General Schwarzkopf wanted to expand the air campaign, wanted to lead with air power, and he needed some strategic thinking on the subject. And we had the bones of a plan, but we needed to flesh it out. And so I needed a strategic air expert in the Pentagon within 24 hours. So he sent about three or four representatives. So within one day, we had a team at the Pentagon under John Warden's leadership putting together a campaign plan that we took within 3 days to General Powell. That was a stormy session, as John Warden will recall, with General Powell and the Army J3 particularly, a fellow named Kelly who was adamantly opposed to air taking the lead in the war. He wanted to be the traditional airland battle. We'll just invade first with the Army. The Air Force will provide close air support, maybe a little bit of interdiction, a deeper interdiction, but nothing of the magnitude that we were talking about. And Colin Powell tended to side with his J3, Kelly. And so Warden leaped in. I had to hold him back a little bit. And then I leaped in at that meeting and said, hey, you know, we've learned from Vietnam that we can't let this go the way you want it to go. We've got to lead with air power, and we're ready to go full blower on it. We've learned a lot since Vietnam about how to wage war with red flag and with new systems coming online. And so we're ready to go with this. So we won that battle. Between myself and Colonel Warden, and then John went off to brief Schwarzkopf at MacDill, but he was ready to go.
Gentlemen, there is some important context here that I think we need to establish as a baseline, and Rich hit upon it earlier. The kind of strategic attack plan we saw employed in Desert Storm did not reflect Air Force doctrine at that time. In fact, you three had to mount a semi-insurgency that countered the prevailing thinking. Because the thinking back then was called airland battle, and it was actually Army doctrine, and it was based on a linear battle with land and air forces operating at the same time, with air forces supporting the Army ground scheme of maneuver. If you each could chime in here, I'd appreciate it, and maybe General Deptula, we'll start with you, with your perspective, and then we'll pass the mic around.
Sure, Slick. I'd tell you that Desert Storm was not based on airland battle. Airland battle had nothing to do with either the planning or the execution of the air campaign. It was built to address a large conventional battle in Central Europe to fight the Soviet Union. Now, the Air Force played a key role in that doctrine, but in the context of supporting the Army scheme of maneuver. It was designed for a different war in a different place, and it had no place in the Desert Storm air campaign strategy. Instead, Desert Storm was a turning point in the conduct of modern warfare. every conflict before it basically saw a linear projection of power. Our forces would start at the edges and we'd fight our way in, occupying territory along the way. However, Desert Storm was fundamentally different because we took an entirely distinctive approach. We struck at the entirety of Iraq's critical leadership, key facilities, and military in the first 24 hours. This was a simultaneous attack. We brought to bear an effects-based focus on targeting key elements of the Saddam regime, as well as focused attacks against his deployed forces, rendering them ineffective. Now, stealth allowed us to get to the target and back without hemorrhaging tons of aircraft and airmen, and precision allowed us to get the bombs on target. One bomb, one kill. Combined, that allowed us to execute an air campaign of such intensity in such a short period of time that the enemy was simply paralyzed, overwhelmed, and crippled to the extent that they collapsed when in the last few days of the war, ground forces were sent in to reoccupy Kuwait and conduct the Great Prisoner Roundup. Iraq's war-making enterprise simply imploded as a result of the air campaign, and it had nothing to do with air-land battle.
Colonel Wharton, if there's anyone who gets the prize for pushing back against air-land battle, an approach I think would have cost thousands of coalition lives and taken far longer to complete, you're the guy. I must ask, what made you leave the comfort of the cruise ship and go back to DC immediately after Saddam Hussein's forces invaded Kuwait? Could you tell us about your instant thunder plan and what prompted you to think about an alternative approach?
Well, so I think there are a couple things that are worth bringing out. The cruise was a lot of fun, and hated to leave it. And I kind of left it in the middle, not physically, but mentally, at least according to my wife, after we saw the Iraqis on the television coming into Kuwait. She said, I just disappeared, even though I couldn't get off the ship until it got back into port. But when I got back and chatted a little bit with Dave and a couple of other people to see what was going on, and in general, all I could find out was there wasn't much, some show of force kinds of things, send some boat or something to the Persian Gulf, nothing that struck me as very serious. So on Monday morning, went into the to the Pentagon and went down into checkmate and just called out to the rest of my deputy director and said, anybody like to come down? We're gonna look at something interesting. And in a short period of time, we probably had 15 or so people down there. And I think the thing that probably was significantly driving my particular thinking on this was that recollection of Vietnam. In Vietnam, everybody, all the Air Force guys fought well, Army guys did well too, everybody did fine, but it was an utter failure. And I said, well, I never want to be a part of this again. So the idea was, let's do something that's completely different. So we sat down with this group of people down in the basement and said, okay, we've been thinking, Dave had been part of the deputy director until he went up to the secretary's office. We've been thinking about this whole concept of air power and using it to win wars. Now let's put together what we have done and create a plan. I said, I don't have a clue how we're going to go about actually selling it, but let's build it and then see where we can go from there. And then the subsequent parts of the story, well, I think we'll get into that. I think I would mention just one thing very quickly here, and that's the original name that we gave to this thing was Instant Thunder. And people say, Instant Thunder, I thought it was called Desert Storm. Well, it was called Desert Storm eventually, but it started out being Instant Thunder. And the idea here was that rather than doing the 10-year-long rolling thunder operation in Vietnam that just went on and on and on, and in which, because it was so slow, that the North Vietnamese were able to work around it pretty effectively, that we're not going to do that. It's not the right way to go about fighting wars. Escalation is not the right way to go about fighting wars. It's to go in there and make something happen. So thus, Instant Thunder, that's the essence of how we got into doing this planning.
General Lowe, what was going on at the senior level at this point? As I understand it, the initial strategy proposal was a headlong assault into the Iraqi forces, and the White House was less than pleased. How did you help Colonel Worden and his team advance their alternative?
Okay, well, let me tell you about a couple of very important meetings at the time. And this is important for our young airmen out there in the Air Force. Don't ever apologize for air power. Don't ever apologize for the value of air power and the importance of air power and leading with air power. Right after Worden went down and briefed Schwarzkopf and we had this little tiff in the Pentagon with Colin Powell, he launched us all off to flesh things out. But from that point on, during September and October of 1990, I happened to be the acting chief of staff of the Air Force, and we had battles, skirmishes in the tank every day with the other chiefs of staff of the other services. And this is where our young airmen need to recognize and take the lead. Don't be obnoxious about air power, but take the lead in demonstrating your knowledge of air power and what it can do and how it must lead the force, because at that time, all four services wanted to take the lead in Desert Storm. The Army was very strong. Of course, Colin Powell was the chairman, but the Army chief of staff at the time wanted to invade Kuwait, kick the Republican Guards out of Kuwait with air support. And he kind of wanted the Air Force to be tethered to the Army in traditional air-land battle nomenclature. The Navy chief of naval operations wanted to revert back to Vietnam. He wanted two carrier battle groups in the Persian Gulf and two carrier battle groups in the Red Sea. And he said, we'll take care of all the air from the eastern side of Iraq and Kuwait, and we'll take care of it all from the western side off the Red Sea from into Iraq. And the Air Force can stay working with the Army in their air-land battle. So they wanted to dominate. These were fierce battles in the tank and the Marine Corps commandant. Don't leave him out, Al Gray. He said, we need an amphibious landing. We need to launch an amphibious landing on the shores of Kuwait and drive the Iraqi guards and drive from there and let the Marines lead the way. And so I say this because I was in there battling every day for why air power needed to lead the way, and we won those fights. But you can't win those fights unless you understand that you just can't be equal when it comes to the four services. You're airmen, you're air power advocates, and you've got to be in there fighting for why air power is valuable, why it needs to lead the way. So that was the first meeting that was very important. And the first lesson learned is don't apologize for air power. Don't try and be one of the boys, you know, equal with the other services. You're not one of the boys. You're airmen, you're air power advocates. Secondly, we went to the White House on October 10th. General Buster Glossin came back from the theater. Horner and Schwarzkopf sent him back to brief the president on what we were doing. And I escorted them. We went to the White House and briefed President Bush. And at that time, Colin Powell had serious reservations about leading with air. He said, we've got to go in with the Army at the same time. And Buster was very emphatic, and so were we, about, hey, you know, we need to break down the Republican Guard. And Glossin had instructions from Schwarzkopf. And I had instructions from Schwarzkopf that we're going to break down and tear down and attrit the Iraqi Republican Guard armies by about 75 or 80% before we allow the Army troops to invade. The Army didn't like that because they had to sit around for 40 days. And while the airmen took their cars, but President Bush supported us entirely. And so we won that battle in terms of air power in the lead. Then in Congress, we had the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Sam Nunn. He called in 8 former chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to come in, and they unanimously said, we don't want a war. We want sanctions to work in Iraq. They essentially said, we don't believe these comments coming out of the Pentagon that air power can be decisive in the early days. President Bush, when we briefed him, he said, he pointed to General Scowcroft, his National Security Advisor, an Air Force retired 3-star, said, Brent, are these guys blowing smoke up my rear end? Are they telling me what can be done? And Schwarzkopf backed us up. He said, no, these guys are telling you exactly what they can do. And they can do it now. And they have the tools to do it now. And so President Bush said, well, let's go to war tomorrow. This was October 11th. He said, let's go to war tomorrow. Let's go. And of course, Colin Powell backed off and said, hey, no, give me 48 hours. We got other things to talk about and think about. So Bush said, Bush said, well, I need to work on the coalition too to get the coalition together. So we need a little bit more time, but I'm ready to go now because I'm convinced that what I'm being told now about the efficacy of air power in this campaign can be accomplished. So again, my point was, as we led up to January 17th, when we started the war, there was a lot of battles going on in what I call the Battle of the Pentagon and the Battle of the Potomac There had to be one, and we won it because we had air power advocates in there who weren't willing to say no, who were willing to stand up to Colin Powell and others and say, you know, we know what we're doing. We've learned a lot from Vietnam. We've got the tools to win and the mentality to win and the firepower to win with overwhelming force. One thing General Powell did support us with, he said, if we're going to go in there, we're going to go in with overwhelming power. So we had enormous air power in Saudi Arabia at the time.
Colonel Worden, could you explain how the shadow of Vietnam shaped the thinking during this time?
Well, one of the things that always amazed me was after the Vietnam War, that for those of us who had participated in it, that there were 7,000 different ideas as to what had happened and what hadn't happened. And the majority of the thinking had been about the tactical things. And a lot of good stuff flowed out of that, as General Lowe mentioned, red flag and so on. We got a heck of a lot better in managing air power and actually using it at a tactical level. But there was little or no agreement at a strategic level on what had gone right or wrong. And certainly I thought that one of the primary problems with Vietnam had been the whole, what I thought was the ridiculous concept of escalation. You do something a little bit and sit back and let the other guy kind of respond and so on. This is just utterly crazy. And then I was amazed that found that there were quite a number of people in the Air Force at senior levels that thought that was exactly the right way to go about doing something. I don't remember how many times as we were going through these discussions through the fall and into the January of 1991, that somebody would say, oh, that's far too violent. In fact, it's sort of an interesting quick story. When we were doing the second presentation to General Schwarzkopf, had gone through the whole thing, and this was just before he said, going head on over to hand the plan off to General Horner. He opened the briefing up and he said, any of the staff have any questions? Well, there happened to be a two-star guy that was there, wasn't an Air Force guy. And this fellow sort of looked around the room a little bit, and he looked right at General Schwarzkopf and he said, you know, this whole thing strikes me as far too violent. Don't you agree? And General Schwarzkopf looked at him. I thought he was going to freeze him to death. He said, no. Are there any other questions? So that was one of the things that kept coming back, too violent, as opposed with people that are thinking that somehow or other that there was some advantage to be gained by doing things slowly and not driving the opponent to exactly where you wanted them as quickly as you possibly could. So it was, Vietnam, in fact, still has not left us. We are still seeing the shadows of really strange ideas about Vietnam, I think, that drove a lot of our operations in Afghanistan and in Iraq.
One of the key elements of success of the air campaign was an effects-based approach that you applied building the master plan, General Deptula. Can you tell our audience about the birth of the effects-based approach during Desert Storm?
Yes, Slick. Actually, it was a coincidence of necessity. Now, as John Worden mentioned, the offensive air campaign planning process began in the basement of the Pentagon. Now, while there, we had discussed the virtues of effects-based planning. But regardless, the initial attack plan was developed on the basis of traditional destruction-based planning methodology. Here's what happened. Early on, the intelligence folks told us that there were two major air defense operation centers that controlled Iraq's air defenses. One was in Baghdad and one was at Talil Air Base in southern Iraq. Now, these were hardened structures consisting of 37 feet of concrete, dirt, and rock on top of two bunkers. The intel and the F-117 weapons officers figured out it would take a combination of four 2,000-pound penetrating GBU-27s and four GBU-10 2,000-pound bombs per bunker, one placed, one directly after another, to dig down to reach the control centers. If you do the math, that's 16 weapons per air defense center to destroy the bunkers. Well, at the time, we only had 16 F-117s designated for planning use. So killing both bunkers in each air operations center used up all the F-117s in the original attack plan. Now, that was worth it if we could blind Iraq's air defenses. Now, let me jump 2 weeks ahead. Now, out of the Pentagon, over to Riyadh, a matter of fact, late August of 1990, we were furiously working to turn the master attack plan into an air tasking order in Riyadh for General Horner. On the 30th of August, General Glossin and I go to Manama, Bahrain to brief Admiral Maz, the commander of the naval forces in the Gulf, on the air campaign plan. Because it was so highly classified and compartmented that, you know, we didn't trust mail, we didn't trust email, we didn't have a robust CIPRNet like we do today. And after we completed the briefing to the Admiral and we're taking off out of Bahrain on our C-21, it fills up with smoke. And the pilot declares an emergency and we return to Bahrain. Well, bottom line is we're waiting for another airplane to come get us. I pull out this intel study that I had requested that described in detail the Iraqi air defense system to get more familiar with it. Because I was just going on what intel told me about these two air operation centers. And as I'm reading this report, I find out that there aren't just two air defense centers in Iraq. There were four. And associated with each one of them were 3 to 5 interceptor operation centers that could take over control and control the entire air defenses. So everything was interconnected. It was a network. As you might expect, this dramatically changed the target planning problem to paralyze their air defense in one blow. So what to do? What I want to do is I want to achieve as much impact across the entire target base as possible to achieve a debilitating effect to allow our non-stealthy aircraft to ingress successfully. But we don't have enough F-117s in order to do that as this target base expanded. So the next day in Riyadh, while we're sitting in our small planning room, the black hole, I postulated that a 2,000-pound bomb could go off in the other end of the building we were in, the Royal Saudi Air Force headquarters. And while we wouldn't be dead, we sure as heck wouldn't be hanging around to finish our coffee. So I figured that we didn't need to destroy each air operation center the first night. We only needed to render it ineffective and to conduct operations. So I went back and I rewrote the attack plan, not putting 8 F-117s on each air operation center, but rather just 1 or 2 bombs on each. And what that did was it freed up 30 GBU-10s and 27s that we could use against other targets, namely the other command centers. And that was the birth of the effects-based approach that I then used throughout the rest of the war in developing the daily attack plans and applied that approach to every target set.
Yeah, I would just add in that Dave, what you did with that really was the thing that made it possible to get the parallel effects on Iraq as a system, because it's easy enough for anybody to respond to damage to a particular target, but when there are dozens of things that are hit at the same time and that they're all not necessarily blown up, but when they're all damaged, it becomes virtually impossible for anybody, doesn't make any difference whether they're Americans or anybody else, to react in any effective way. So that particular approach was, I think, was substantial and probably one of the key things, i.e. concepts, that we really have failed to pick up adequately in the post-Iraq wars that have gone on.
Yes, sir, I'd agree 1,000%.
Gentlemen, given that we are at the 30-year mark, the 30th anniversary of the first Gulf War Desert Storm, and looking back in retrospect, if you could each highlight your top takeaway from Desert Storm, what would it be? So much has happened since then. It seems like we could relearn, or we must relearn, much of what you were pushing for back then. Gentlemen, over to you.
Kind of the last thing I'd like to, point that I'd like to make is that every war needs to lead with air power. Every war needs to lead with air power. We did it in Desert Storm. We haven't done it since. When we went back to Iraq in 2003, the planners at that time said, oh, no, now we're going to go back and we're going to let the Army and the Air Force kick off together. The Army's going to invade Iraq while the Air Force is doing both a little bit of that shock and awe stuff, but it's going to be done simultaneously, and the Navy and the Marines are going to simultaneously attack. That was a disaster. Schwarzkopf had the right idea. Bush had the right, let the airmen win, trip the enemy by 75% before you launch the ground forces. And so we had 40 days of air power followed by 4 days of Army mop-up and we won the war, overwhelmingly, victory. And so, you know, this notion that we have to share resources and share responsibility from day one on is nonsense. You don't operate air power independently as part of the joint commander's operational plan like it was with Schwarzkopf. We're going to lead with air power, but all the other components of military ability is going to take part at the right time and at the right place. And so the air campaign during Desert Storm was part of the joint commander's force. It wasn't the flyboys out there doing their own thing. It was part of the joint campaign. The last point is, we won this war thanks to you guys, John and Dave and the others, by winning quickly, by overwhelming force, providing overwhelming force, winning quickly, having a goal, which was kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait and stop then. We did stop then, and we had few casualties. And so we haven't been able to do that since then. We haven't defined the clarity of mission and sufficiency of force to do that. So that's the final lesson I have. Over.
Well, I've got three top takeaways that were proven under fire in Desert Storm and that still have great relevance for today and the future. First, the value of a single functional component commander for aerospace forces, the Joint Force Aerospace Force Component Commander, to achieve unity of effect among all aerospace forces. Number two, the value of an effects-based approach to planning and execution of any conflict. Starting by establishing the desired outcome and then working backwards to determine how to get to that end state in the most rapid time possible. Now, this kind of a methodology is not a calculable equation, as some ground power zealots claim, but rather it's an approach that is extraordinarily adaptable to any warfighting scenario, and that if we had applied it in Afghanistan, perhaps we'd not still be there going on 20 years. And three, jointness works, but only true jointness. That is, using the right force at the right place at the right time, not the little league rules where everyone gets to play or everyone gets an equal share. This is, you know, capitalizing on what General Lowe's comment was in terms of using your best advantage and putting your best foot forward first. Now, every conflict is going to be different, calling for different force mixes. But I think that's a key takeaway that today we've lost. People are interpreting jointness as homogeneity and everyone gets to play and we all get along and go along to get along. And that's not what jointness is. Jointness is about using our key strengths. And General Schwarzkopf is to be commended because he did that in Desert Storm. The first 90% of it was uniquely air power, and outside of a couple of soft forces was air power alone. Well, that went a long way in saving a lot of American sons and daughters' lives. And only in the last part, where we needed ground forces to go in and reoccupy Kuwait, did we use them. So those are my three key takeaways.
For the last, almost since the end of that war, that I've been working on strategy things and primarily in the business world. And one of my observations is that it's very rare that a company doesn't do well because that they're not very good at manufacturing or whatever. It's because that they haven't thought through a good strategy and they haven't come up with it. And I believe that one of the primary problems that we have suffered for the last several years, the same thing General Lowe said, General Abdullah said, is that we have failed to have a clear definition of a solid win. And without a clear definition of this is winning and we're going to make it happen, and then working backwards, strategically working backwards, identifying the parts of the enemy as a system that need to be collapsed or have to change in some particular way, and then making things happen with such rapidity that it becomes virtually impossible for an opponent to react to you, that these are the kinds of things that will bring a high probability of victory, of success, even in the event that you are outnumbered, as we easily could be in a near peer competition if we end up with something on the other side of the Pacific. We got to start with a strategy. Unfortunately, the tendency is in the Air Force, in the Army, in business for that matter, that people start with tactical details and say, gee, I'm pretty good at manufacturing something. So all we need to do is do more manufacturing and everything will be fine. It's simply not the case. You've got to start up at the top strategic level and then work backwards and then figure out the right tactics. And it's at that point where exactly what Dave is saying comes to play, that the right tactics are dictated by the strategic objective, not by some kind of nonsensical distribution of or equal distribution of tasks across the participants.
Gentlemen, thank you for your collective insights that to date have not been widely known. It's been an honor to speak with you and get these insights. Here's something that kept hitting me during the conversations. In looking back at history, it's so easy to think of things as a fixed set of events. But here's proof that it all comes down to people standing up for what is right and pushing it up when the chips are down. Without General Low, General Deptula, and Colonel Warden, Desert Storm would have looked way different and it wouldn't have been the slam dunk victory we remembered today. These guys really stuck out their necks into the headwinds of the bureaucracy. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. Our next episode, the second installment of our Desert Storm series, will feature a conversation between General Chuck Horner and General David Deptula. General Horner was the top air commander for Desert Storm, and Deptula, then a lieutenant colonel, led the construction of the air campaign plan. This will afford you a front row seat to the next phase of how the war was planned and executed. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for today's discussions and to you, our listeners, for tuning in to this special Desert Storm edition of the Aerospace Advantage. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or by visiting us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. Until next time, fly safe and check six.